Hello, and welcome to the Love Mia Vita podcast. I'm Jerry DiPiano, CEO of FemPharma. Thank you for joining me as we discuss all things women's health and wellness. Please note that this information is simply that. It's information to help you to think through your decisions. Please consult your medical practitioner to discuss your personal situation. Thank you. Hi, this is Jerry DiPiano again, and I'm here with Dr. Catherine Sharif, who is my co-host. And Dr. Sharif is professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University. And Catherine, in case the listeners and viewers have not met you before in the Love Mia Vita podcast, perhaps you could share a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I'm an internist in Philadelphia at Thomas Jefferson University, and I work in a women's health center, which is called Jefferson Women's Primary Care. And we treat the whole woman, and we believe women shouldn't be forced to go to two different doctors to get their care.
So it's amazing. Imagine that, total woman care. So Dr. Sharif looks after the whole body, not just the reproductive organs, although they certainly part of a woman's body. But today we are going to discuss a topic that we need to pay attention to, in fact, at every age. And this is a two-part series. So the two-part series, the first part of the series is cardiovascular health in women who are greater than 50 years of age. But that does not mean young women who are under 50 should not pay attention to the cardiovascular health, because what we're seeing is that women aged 35 to 54 years, the numbers are not looking good, women. In fact, we are seeing more heart disease in the younger population. It is increasing cardiovascular disease risk in younger women of all ethnicities and racial groups is increasing. It is especially increasing in areas where we have minority groups, Black and other minorities, ethnic minorities. We're seeing a significant increase. So we need to pay attention, and that will be the topic for part two, because there are also some unique factors that predispose you to cardiovascular disease. We want to identify what can be done to change the course of that disease. So with that, did you have anything to add, Catherine? It's a mouthful.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I'm grateful that we're talking about this topic. But in another way, I'm really disheartened. 30 years ago, in 1994, I wrote the first cases for medical students about heart disease in women. And it was novel. No one ever talked about heart disease in women. And, you know, medical students get cases and they have to figure out how to go through, what's the diagnosis, and so on. And so these were unique because no one had ever had written cases about heart disease in women. And it was to raise awareness. And I can't believe we're having the same conversations 30 years later about the lack of awareness.
So not much has changed. What our viewers may not know is the early part of my career, I worked in a multinational pharmaceutical company where we were developing cardiovascular drugs. And guess who wasn't included in our clinical research? So it wasn't until after 1993 that we were required, pharmaceutical manufacturers, researchers, and drug developers were required to include women in clinical studies. And they were supposed to match up the incidence and prevalence of the disease or disorder with the recruitment of the study population. As Catherine said, very little has changed. So we have a lot of work ahead of us, even today.
Sure do. We really do.
But we're working on it. Yes, we can. We will. In any event, so Catherine, I know you have a lovely slide deck that you would like to share with us, and I'd like you to do that now if you can.
Okay. The slides are coming up. Okay. So the first fact that people should know is that in one third of women who have heart disease, their very first symptom is sudden death. Not chest pain, not shortness of breath, but sudden death. And so we never get a second chance with those women.
Pretty incredible.
It is incredible. So, cardiovascular disease, meaning heart attack and stroke, which are related because they're in the blood vessels, it's the leading cause of death for women. And of all the women who are listening, to this podcast, one out of two will die from heart disease. It affects 44 million women in the United States today. And more when women have a heart attack, they're much more likely to die than when men have a heart attack, and especially if they're younger. And heart disease kills one woman every 80 seconds in this country.
So that's pretty tough to wrap my head around, although I will say that because I had a mom who largely succumbed to cardiovascular disease, so I'll tell you a little bit of a little vignette here. So when my dad was actually had heart disease and he was in the late stages of heart failure, my mom was his caregiver and she was just exhausted, but she and so she brought in someone that could assist her. But obviously, she was still on duty 24/7 for the most part. And she started experiencing chest pain and she went to her primary care practitioner. It wasn't you, Catherine. It was someone who was significantly less qualified and aware of these things. And he told her that she had a gastrointestinal issue, GERD. He told her that she had GERD and he prescribed something for her and she went home and that was the end of it. And within a month, she ended up with crushing chest pain at home. She called her doctor again and he said it was probably the stress of taking care of my dad. She ended up in the ICU at Johns Hopkins University Hospital, almost dead. It's a miracle that she actually survived and had four occluded arteries, quadruple bypass surgery, and multiple complications. The good news was that she survived the surgery and the complications, but she could have had this issue addressed long before she nearly died. So that's my story. And sadly, even years later, the damage to her heart ended up ending her life.
So when she first had the symptoms, her physician told her she had reflux.
Yes.
Yeah.
And likely that it was more, it could be more significant, and she should probably have diagnostic tests because potentially she had esophageal cancer.
Excellent. So when I was a resident, I may have told you this before, we had something called the Malox sign, which is when a woman had Malox dripping out of her mouth. She came in with chest pain. She was put in the GYN room. She was treated like she had stomach problems given Malox. And then it became evident that she was having a heart attack. Then she'd be whisked off to the cath lab to get a cardiac catheterization. And the Malox sign was the Malox that she had been given for her chest pain that was felt to be due to heartburn. We saw it over and over. Okay. So, as I said, it's the leading cause of death, cardiovascular disease, that's heart attack and stroke. And that is more than all the cancers put together, including breast cancer in this country. And what this slide shows you, this is from the American Heart Association. is mortality and reinfarction. So when women have a heart attack, women here are in blue and men are in yellow. When women have a heart attack, 45% die, almost half, within the first year, compared to men, only 20% die in the first year. Now, if they don't die, they're at risk for reinfarction. And what that means is when you infarct your heart muscle, you block the oxygen because one of those arteries was blocked. So you block the oxygen, that muscle that was fed by that blood vessel dies, but the rest of the heart is receiving blood and oxygen. However, you can reinfarct and knock off another piece of your heart muscle. So in the year after having a heart attack, 40% of women will reinfarct versus 13% of men. So almost four times as much more likely to reinfarct. And there are many reasons for this. And then what happens is if you keep killing off pieces of the heart muscle, you end up with a big flabby balloon that can't quite pump. And that is essentially heart failure.
So I'm curious, what are some of the reasons why women reinfarct, Catherine?
One of the reasons they may reinfarct is that they don't get the most aggressive treatment. And so we all know that the rules are if you get a heart attack, you go on a cholesterol lowering drug, you go on a beta blocker, and there are other medications. You go on an ACE inhibitor, and that prevents you from reinfarction. And that's what we all know, that everybody with a heart attack is supposed to get those medications. In practice, women are less likely to get those medications than men. And no one starts out by saying, I'm going to treat every woman I see. I'm going to treat her suboptimally, and I'm going to give her half the medicines. But it just happens. And it also happens in minorities. It just happens. There's always a reason, but no one starts out saying like they're going to give bad care. Another thing is that a woman may have had a heart attack, no one realized what it was, and then she reinfarcts because she's not treated. So under treatment or no treatment.
So this would be, I hate to use the expression silent heart attack, but if she had a coronary artery spasm or something along those lines, perhaps it wasn't diagnosed or was passed off as anxiety and stress or a panic attack. So it was, and by the way, she may have had an EKG and it didn't show up on an EKG.
Exactly. That's another problem is with the diagnostic tests, they're not always accurate in women. And in fact, if you look at studies where you get an EKG during all phases of the menstrual cycle, what you'll see is that the EKG looks different depending on what week it is with your hormones. So if we don't study that, then how can we use the EKG accurately if we don't even understand why it changes during the menstrual cycle?
Would that also apply to women who are, let's say a woman has entered perimenopause or menopause and she's using hormone replacement therapy, would that also apply?
We don't know. No one's looked at EKGs for menopausal women on hormone replacement therapy.
Just had to ask the question.
You had to ask. Yeah. And you know, all heart attacks are not the same. So traditionally, we think of heart attacks as you have an artery, it has plaque in it, atherosclerotic plaque, and then you end up blocking it. It's like a straw that's blocked, and then oxygen doesn't get through further downstream. But there's, and then that in a man will clearly show up as a heart attack. It's called you get ST elevations on the EKG. ST elevations are a certain pattern on the EKG, and then it's clear they're having a heart attack. But women, especially, and minorities can get a different type of heart attack that does not is not caused by a blockage of the coronary artery. And so and that is called INOCA or MINOCA. So INOCA, INOCA, stands for ischemia with no obstruction of the coronary artery. Ischemia meaning a lack of oxygen, blood isn't getting through. MINOCA means myocardial infarction, heart attack, MINOCA, with no coronary artery obstruction. And what it is it isn't those arteries that we're always studying with the catheterizations. It's the tiny arteries of the heart contract, and they can cause a heart attack that way. And so that's not something that it occurs more often in women. So let's say that you have chest pain, you're seen, you're a 65-year-old woman, you're in the emergency room, and you're having classic chest pain. And they do an EKG, and there's nothing special about the EKG, except we can tell you're sick, you have chest pain, you're short of breath. So you go to the catheterization lab, and when they put the dye into the coronary arteries, there's no blockages. Maybe there's a little bit here, a little bit here, but no complete blockage. But you're still having a heart attack, but it's not recognized. So most cardiac catheterization labs do not have the equipment to be able to tell that someone is having a heart attack called INOCA or MINOCA. How's that?
Disparities and disparities and more disparities based upon sex, gender, and ethnicity. What can I say?
Yes. And speaking of disparities, this is a study that was published in 1999, and the findings are not very different today. It's one of my favorite studies. And so physicians were given a written description of a person and shown one of eight of these photos. And the photos are of two Black women, two Black men, two white men, women, and two white men. And lots of physicians participated in this study. And no matter what picture you got a description of this person. This is a 70-year-old man, woman, white, Black, who has high blood pressure and diabetes. And they develop chest pain while walking the dog this morning, and they have shortness of breath, and they threw up only once. So a history just like that. Now, what would you do with this patient? Well, if you were a doctor and you got a picture of one of the two white men, you would send those men to the cath lab so fast, okay? And if you were Black woman, you would be lucky if you got to the cath lab. In fact, women, white women, were 40% less likely to be sent to the cath lab in that scenario compared to white men. And Black men were also 40% less likely to go to the cath lab. And then the numbers for Black women were lower than 40%. And so what that tells us is that the physician is thinking is, now that's a classic presentation of a heart attack. It was the exact same presentation, but the white men received the appropriate care and everyone else didn't.
So as a further digression, when we had my dad with his cardiovascular issues, they immediately did the cardiac catheterization. It was not even a question. Nobody second-guessed it. He's going to the cath lab. He got the head of the cardiac cath lab to do the cardiac catheterization. Mom fared less well, and she went to the same hospital. By the way, high praise for Johns Hopkins Hospital, fabulous hospital. But again, that doesn't change the fact that her, gender, her sex, played a role in not doing the proper job of diagnostic work or workup.
Yes. My mother also was had a probably had her first heart attack at 45, but it was called heartburn. And so she took a lot of meds for heartburn over the years. And she had successive heart attacks. And then she got heart failure and died at 69. And she was young. My father had a heart attack at 87 when he was chopping down a tree. So,
Wow.
yeah, and when he had chest pain, he went straight to the cath lab.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. So, some sex differences in presentation. Now, both men and women get pain in their chest, maybe in their jaw, their neck, or their back, and they can get shortness of breath. So there are differences, but it's not that women don't get chest pain, or they make this sign called the Levine sign, where you make a fist and you say, "I feel pressure right here in the center of my chest." They get that, but they also get other symptoms. They may feel lightheaded without chest pain. They may have indigestion, what feels like indigestion, and burping and nausea. They may have unusual fatigue. In the weeks before having a heart attack, women may say, "I'm getting more and more tired, and I'm walking the same distance, and nothing's changed." So we have to have our antenna up. So the most common symptom in acute MI, an acute heart attack, is chest pain in both men and women. 99% of women had chest pain on presentation. So it's not like they don't have the classic findings. And then these are all the other symptoms. You'll see they're higher in women than in what men. In this slide, women are in orange, men are blue. And you'll see they're more likely to have dyspnea, which is shortness of breath. They're three times more likely than men to have nausea and vomiting. They're more likely to have indigestion, fatigue, sweating, and arm and shoulder pain.
So looking at this information, when I give a little bit of grace to the healthcare practitioner, because one could confuse the indigestion with gastrointestinal issue and not pay attention to some of the other symptoms. So just a little bit of grace for the healthcare practitioner that may see this presentation and not identify that it is unique or more, I should say, more prevalent in women.
Yes. Now let's talk about risk factors. What puts you at risk for having a heart attack? We have traditional risk factors, and at some point we're going to discuss non-traditional risk factors. But traditional risk factors start with age. There isn't a whole lot you can do about that. You are more likely to have a heart attack at 60 than you are at 30, and that's just a fact of life. Abnormal cholesterol, or what we call dyslipidemia. So we have one good type of cholesterol, which is called HDL, and we have several types of bad cholesterol, and the most important of which is LDL, low density lipoprotein. And if you want to remember which one is you want to be high, remember that HDL, the good one, is H, high density lipoprotein. We want it to be high. Now, when you have a high LDL cholesterol, that puts you at risk for heart disease because the LDL is the primary type of cholesterol that goes into the arteries and starts building plaques in the arteries. If you have a low HDL, that makes the bad one, the LDL, makes it more powerful. Another type of bad cholesterol is called triglycerides, and those can be high if you take the birth control pill, if you eat a lot of carbs, if you drink alcohol, if you gain a lot of weight. If you're diabetic and your sugar's out of control, your triglycerides will be very high. Now, we tend to not focus on triglycerides, but guess what? They seem to be more significant in causing heart disease in women compared to men. But our drugs, the statins, which lower LDL, they focus on the LDL almost exclusively and not the triglycerides. But more about that later.
Why is it that triglycerides, you tend to find higher triglycerides in women?
Well, women tend to weigh more than men do. So when you weigh more, or you have not just weigh more, you have more fat mass and less muscle mass, you will have higher triglycerides. Diabetes is a very important risk factor for heart disease. And in fact, one of the ways that we think about diabetes is that it takes your advantage for not having heart disease as a woman. You're diagnosed with diabetes. Now your risk is equivalent to that of a man.
On that topic of diabetes, if you are a woman who perhaps you're 55 years old, but you have lived with polycystic ovarian syndrome for years, are you at greater risk for cardiovascular disease?
Absolutely. So women with PCOS, by age 40, 50% of them have type 2 diabetes. And then it's all downhill from there. Once you develop the diabetes, triglycerides go up, LDL goes up, the good cholesterol, HDL goes down, your blood pressure goes up, and so on and so forth. Yes. So women with PCOS are at very high risk. Hypertension, high blood pressure is the greatest risk factor for stroke. Smoking cigarettes doubles the risk for a heart attack. And if you have a family history of premature heart attack, you're at very high risk.
So I have to ask the question on smoking, and I'm not trying to be cute or funny about this, but we talk about smoking tobacco. What about smoking marijuana? Do we know much about that as a risk factor? Because let's face it, we know that there's medical marijuana. Not every state has medical marijuana, but we know many states have the recreational marijuana laws are quite liberal. But there is medical marijuana and people do smoke.
Yes. So the jury is out, and this is because it hasn't been studied, medical marijuana for smoking it, which is obviously bad for your lungs, versus ingesting it. So it's controversial, and there's new data showing an association, but we don't know a causation with all kinds of cancer and marijuana, but it may not, again, it may not be a causation.
It's a curiosity because I would assume that anything that you put in your lungs, particularly if you vape that we know that folks vape, just as a curiosity. Thanks.
Yeah, I really worry about the vaping. Okay, so other risk factors include being overweight. So 60% of Americans are overweight, a lack of physical activity, and I don't want people to blame themselves or beat themselves up for a lack of physical activity. It's not built into our world. And so for you to be organized and be physically active, it means you shouldn't be working two or three jobs. It means that you may need to have money or disposable income for a gym or to do other sports that require money. We are not encouraged to walk. If we had a lot of trains the way we used to, people would walk to the train and get some exercise there, but everybody has a car. and trains were removed and highways were built. So the structure of our society doesn't support physical activity, and it takes a great deal of energy to be consistent. Nutrition, I was going to say we could spend a whole hour talking about nutrition. And in fact, we have.
Yes, we have.
Nutrition for life. So our food is not really food. And our food supply is controlled by agribusiness. And this is such a enormous topic. So we won't address this now.
But if you want to learn more about it, you could check out the podcast Food as Medicine, which Dr. Sharif and I recorded a little while ago. But Food as Medicine is one of the Mia Vita Love Mia Vita podcasts. So check that out.
A lack of emotional support. We know that one of the biggest open secrets is that people are so lonely and so emotionally lonely. That there's an emotional lack of support, and people live by themselves and are not part of a community. There's psychosocial stress, and then also people who work at their jobs and just feel like the jobs are unbearable experience stress. I do feel like your job can kill you. As I said, a lack of community and depression is also a risk factor.
I don't mean to chuckle about your job killing you, but let's face it. We know that there are environments that are unhealthy environments, and it could be that you work in a healthcare company, but it is unhealthy because there's zero tolerance for you. From a psychological perspective, there's zero tolerance for you from a sociological or philosophical situation. And if you have the luxury to find your way to something that you can enjoy, I always encourage people to, you know, you have to love what you love. If you're going to do it 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 hours a day, you better love it.
It's true. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about hypertension in women. The risk starts to increase at what we call a normal blood pressure. So in other words, when a woman has a blood pressure of 110 over 70, great, no increased risk in heart disease. As soon as her blood pressure goes to 120 over 80, she has a higher risk. And that is because 120 over 80 is confers more of a risk than 110 over 70. And so when she gets to 130 over 85, 140 over 90, she may already have done a lot of damage to her arteries. And that's how hypertension works. So the reference ranges we have for what a normal blood pressure is are based on men. So when boys and girls are growing up, they have the same levels of what constitutes normal blood pressure and abnormal blood pressure. As soon as they have very different reference ranges. Boys are allowed to have higher blood pressures before it's called abnormal, and girls have lower blood pressures. Then what happens is they turn 18, and now we just have one standard, which is if you're 140 over 90, you are hypertensive. But that's too high for women to call hypertension. But we don't have sex-based reference ranges for women. So by the time women reach 140, not over 90, they've already had damage to their blood vessels from hypertension because they are vulnerable at lower blood pressures. And you can already see that they are spilling protein into their urine. And that is a sign that your blood pressure is not controlled and that you're whacking the arteries in the kidney. Here's a slide which shows that your cardiovascular risk or mortality, death from heart disease and stroke, doubles with each 20 over 10 increase in blood pressure. So when if you're 115 over 75, that's pretty good. When you go up by 20 on top and 10 on the bottom, 135 over 85, you actually double your risk for a heart attack, and it just keeps going up like that. And it's worse in women. Here's a slide that depicts how high triglycerides in women, which are the orange bars in the back, compared to triglycerides in men, how high triglycerides are more likely to cause be associated with a heart attack in women, almost double in some cases compared to men. And again, we don't really pay attention to triglycerides. This is from the Framingham Heart Study, and it showed that when patients have diabetes, women do worse. So the light blue bars are men, and the darker blue bars are women. And when women have so when women have diabetes, take a look at the middle two bars. You'll see that's cardiac failure. They are much more likely, at least 30, 40% more likely to have heart failure when they have diabetes compared to men who have heart failure. And they're more likely to have CHD, which is coronary heart disease, which is blockage of the arteries. So, risk factors in women that are not listed with traditional factors, this is in textbooks, include irregular menstrual periods, and polycystic ovary syndrome is the major cause of irregular menstrual periods. One of the ways that we need to think about the health of women is what are their menstrual periods doing, or what did they do when they had periods? We need to treat it as a vital sign, just like the blood pressure. Women who've had gestational diabetes, so they only had diabetes in pregnancy, that puts you at risk for heart disease and stroke. But we don't count that, right? We don't say during the pregnancy, you know what? You've developed diabetes. We have to be very aggressive. After your baby is born, we need to be very aggressive and prevent heart disease. Nobody talks to women like that. Preeclampsia, that's when your blood pressure goes up during your pregnancy. That puts you at risk for heart disease. Early menopause. The average age of menopause in this country is 50. But early menopause, when you have premature menopause, 39, 40, 41, it puts you at greater risk for heart disease.
So that would also include women who have been put into chemical menopause or surgical menopause, correct?
Absolutely right. Surgical menopause, ovaries out, uterus out, and then suddenly they're in menopause and their risk skyrockets. Autoimmune diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and then something that we underdiagnose all the time, sleep apnea, that puts you at risk, great risk.
I have a question with respect to the irregular menstrual periods and another subtopic, which is dysmenorrhea or painful periods. Young women are oftentimes placed on oral contraceptives or, I should say, systemic contraceptive. And does that mask this?
So the question is, are they at greater risk
Right.
if you have irregular periods and you go on the pill? It does not seem, we don't quite know if you no one has studied women who were put on the pill at age 15 for irregular periods and then what happened to them later. And one of the questions would be, well, how long were you on the pill? Were you on for 5 years or 20 years? Did you have pregnancies or no pregnancies? And so on. And that's a great question, Jerry. That's something we should study.
It's something that we need to better understand because, as you know better than anybody, because of your expertise, particularly in PCOS, the symptoms are often masked because women end up on oral contraceptives to address some of what is, troubling symptoms. And then the question is what you just stated. What does that do to change your risk factors? Does it change your risk factors? And I guess the answer is we just don't know. And this is really a recurring theme.
So, atherosclerosis is the name of the condition where there's plaque in your arteries. Plaque is the buildup of cholesterol. It's mainly LDL cholesterol. And if it's the blood vessels in the heart, you can get a heart attack or heart failure. If it's in the brain, you can get a stroke. If it's in your arms and legs, or the blood vessels feeding your arms and legs, we call that peripheral vascular disease or peripheral arterial disease. Or maybe you've heard the term, the initials PAD. And so that's what we typically think of as having poor circulation. And then finally, if you have a buildup of atherosclerosis in the arteries that feed the kidney, that can bring on hypertension. So here's the blood supply for the heart. On the left side of the picture, you'll see the right coronary artery. And then you'll see the middle artery, which is the left anterior descending artery, which is the largest coronary artery. And on the right is the circumflex artery. And those are the big three arteries that may be blocked with atherosclerosis. And you'll see that since they feed different parts of the heart, if you block one, you block the supply to the muscles in that part of the heart. And here's the timeline for atherosclerosis. This is an old slide from 1998, but it is one of my favorites. And what it shows you is that atherosclerosis in our country starts at a very young age. And this was discovered in the 70s. If a child had an autopsy, a child was killed accidentally, they would see that there are foam cells already in the artery. And this is on the left side of this picture of the artery. So foam cells are when the first few LDL particles are laid down in the artery. So children as young as 5 years old have foam cells. The next part is a fatty streak where you build up more of the LDL cholesterol. And you can see that by age 10 or so. And then little by little by little, you build up plaque in the arteries till. They're just given different names based on the size. Now, at the very last part on the right in that artery is a complicated lesion. And what the yellow part is actually, I'll outline this. The yellow part here is all the LDL cholesterol that was dumped into the artery. And you can see that the artery is getting narrower and narrower as it builds up. And then, because LDL is cholesterol, which is fat, it's actually easy to rupture because it's not hard. It's not a scar. It's soft fat. And if it ruptures, all these platelets run to that area to try to heal it. And what you'll see on top of the yellow LDL cholesterol here is you'll see a bunch of platelets. Platelets are trying to stop a heart attack, and they're trying to heal something that ruptured. And when they get there, what happens is you may get a big clot, and then the clot, it's actually the clot that blocks the arteries. And that's how that works. Scary, huh?
Scary that you start as that you start in the first decade of life with
Yeah.
that would be that, and the question would be, how do we change that dynamic?
Yeah. Okay. here's microcirculation of the heart. So it's not just the big ones, which you can see here are outlined in this dye, but there are millions of tiny, tiny arteries. So when you're not having a classic heart attack where you block one of the coronary arteries, you might actually get a contraction of all these small, tiny arteries in what we call is INOCA or MINOCA, and that's ischemia with no coronary obstruction. Okay, so what are some of the disparities in treatment? Well, women are less likely to get a catheterization or to get one quickly. They're less likely. This is data from 30 years ago, and it holds true for today. Less likely to get an aspirin, less likely to get a statin, a cholesterol-lowering drug, and less likely to get an ACE inhibitor, which is a type of hypertension drug that protects you from future heart attacks. Women are also less likely to be referred for cardiac rehab. Insurance pays for it. And of course, they're less likely to be included in heart disease studies, even though it's mandated to include women in heart disease studies. So why do they do worse? Well, they may be older and sicker at the pre at presentation. That has always been the dominant paradigm, which is, why do they do worse? Well, they live longer, they get heart disease later, and they're older by that point, and that's why they don't do well. But that's actually not true. There is a lack of knowledge of physiologic differences. Just take the EKG. Why is it not so accurate? Here's something I used to hear over and over. We would send women for a stress test. And let's say you walk on a treadmill, and then they give you dye, and then they say, oh, is the heart taking up dye, or is there one part of the heart that's not taking up dye because it's already blocked? And a lot of times, what the report would say is, well, I don't know, the stress test was equivocal because the breasts were interfering with the ability to evaluate this study. Well, as long as I can remember, women have had breasts and they're going to bring them with them to the stress test.
I don't leave my breasts behind when I travel.
Exactly. So women present differently, maybe more shortness of breath, nausea and vomiting, management is less aggressive, and there's confusion about diagnostic studies. There's still confusion. And there's less awareness of the significance of risk factors, both traditional and non-traditional.
On the subject, before we leave this subject of the diagnostic tests, what about the thallium or dobutamine? These are pharmacologic agents that are used as surrogates to do a stress test. Do they work better in women or not?
The jury is out.
Okay.
We have other agents that I'd like to get into more into part two.
Okay.
Okay. What I do want people to know, because this is kind of a depressing news all over, I want women to know that atherosclerosis is preventable. Some of the tools that we can check are your A1C, your 3-month sugar. If your 3-month sugar is 6.5 or above, you have diabetes. If it's 5.7 to 6.4, you're pre-diabetes. But I don't want you to be 5.7 or 5.8. And when you see that on your blood tests, anything that breaks down into sugar will raise your A1C. So when you see it, you can make changes in your diet. It could be sweets, it could be candy, it could be pastries, or it could be alcohol. No judgment. It's just things that break down to sugar. Your blood pressure, it has been shown that if you follow the DASH diet, which is dietary approaches to stop hypertension, this is a diet where you get lots of fruits and vegetables. If you do that, you can make a significant dent in your blood pressure. But people, It seems to me people would rather take three or four blood pressure medications than eat more fruits and vegetables. But it's under your control. That's the point. It's under your control. Your cholesterol is under your control. And things that raise the LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, gaining weight, smoking cigarettes, eating too much meat. And I have a news flash, chicken is meat. But the chicken industry has done a very good job of making themselves not meat. They are meat, most certainly meat. LDL will go up just as much as if you eat beef, also under your control. Diet is under your control. We need more education. Most of the insurance companies that insure people in our area will not cover dietary counseling unless you have cancer or AIDS or diabetes. So nothing with prevention. They're not interested in prevention. Exercise is life-changing, and fiber can also be life-changing. So that's the ABCDEF of things that are under our control.
All good points. We cover, as we mentioned earlier during this particular podcast, we do cover the food as medicine. So I strongly encourage any of our listeners and viewers to check out that podcast. It's actually quite good, if I must say so myself. And Dr. Sharif does a good job of making some recommendations as to how you can change up the diet without going crazy.
Other things we can do, treat sleep apnea if you have it. And the majority of my patients say that they can't stand wearing the mask. Then go back and work with your doctors to find a solution because your life depends on it. Take a statin if your LDL is high, especially if it runs in your family and diet doesn't seem to make any difference. Treat your depression. Build community. And then here's a new one. Read old CAT scans for notes about atherosclerosis. So what I mean about that is that let's say that you had severe shortness of breath and you ended up in the emergency room and they did a CAT scan because they were looking for, let's say, a blood clot, or maybe you had a complicated pneumonia. When you look at that old CAT scan, read the report. The question may be, does this person have a blood clot in the lungs? Answer yes or no. But there's other information on CAT scans, and it may say something like, yes, and there's a lot of calcifications in the coronary arteries, which would tell you there's a whole bunch of plaque in the coronary arteries. And if you already have plaque, you should take a statin to start shrinking the size of those atherosclerotic plaques in your arteries.
Great advice. So here we are again without the slides, and these are great tips. I guess the takeaway for me, Catherine, is with the understanding that we don't have enough clinical research specifically in women as they move from their reproductive age group cohort through the menopausal transition. The best thing that we can do as women is to be our best advocates, to understand what is missing, and to try to help our healthcare practitioners and professionals to fill in the gaps by asking the right questions. At least that's what I would do. Now that I had some of this information, I would definitely do something that you suggested, which is check those old CAT scans to the extent that you've had them. But what are the three tips? All joking aside, because this is a serious topic, and I love that you talked about what we can do as opposed to the doom and gloom. So what are the three or four tips that you would provide to our listeners?
Tip number one is when you go to your primary care physician, you are probably going to get an A1C. You will get a blood pressure check and a cholesterol check, or what we call lipids. So pay very close attention to those numbers and see if you can modify them using diet and exercise. I really do believe that most people could get off hypertension medications if they tried, if they really, really tried. And that tells, and I know a lot of people don't want to take medications, but it tells you how hard it is to change habits. So first of all, get the information and then speak to your primary care physician about what your risk of heart disease is based on all your risk factors, including your family. And so that would be tip number one. Tip number two is you have to examine your diet. And I think we covered so much ground in Food as Medicine podcast. I think that would be a great place to start. If your insurance won't pay for dietary counseling, then it's your responsibility to educate yourself and see where our food is coming from and what are you going to do about it. And then number three is you have to be physically active. No excuses. You got to find a way to do it.
It's also good for for your mental health. So it's a super, super good way to get those endorphins charging forward and making you feel good that you're making some effort. But that, as always, Catherine, it's wonderful to have you as my co-host. I learn a lot every time we do these things. And I know our audience has commented that they do as well. So I want to thank Dr. Catherine Sharif. Catherine, until the next time. So thank you. And we're signing off until
Thank
next
you.
time. Thank you for joining us on the Love Mia Vita podcast. Love Mia Vita means love my life, and that is a mantra we should all live by. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and check out our website at fempharma.com. Remember to live well and love Mia Vita.